garden going in from the back. Yeah. I mean, which had notoriously just been nothing for so long. So that's kind of exciting.
And yeah. How are
the gyms doing? They're good. They're always good. Yeah. That's always good. Recognition is good, right? Yeah.
It is nice. Yeah. I'm not being fully recognized on this thing.
You're not.
There, now I am.
Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome. All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks. All right. I hope to be at Float Away within the next night or two.
All right.
I love it.
Yeah, I love Float Away too. It's the food that we always take home, you know, yeah. Like out of all the restaurants. Yeah. It's like,
very cool.
You bring home a pizza or some pasta. It's like, yeah. Yeah.
Is Float Away the baby or Bacchanalia?
Well, Bacchanalia is the first.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But Float Away is 15 years old now. Congrats. Yeah, we opened in 98, so it's pretty old. And I think when we opened Bacchanalia, originally it was the food was closer to what Float Away's is than what Bacchanalia is now. I think it was Bacchanalia kind of evolved.
Closer to.
Okay. So you want me to talk into it? Yeah. Yeah, it's fine. It's just so big. I can't really see you, so. Okay, yeah. I can't see that far away.
You know, speaking about duration of restaurants and just like age and what have you, July 3rd will be my 18th year anniversary of moving to Atlanta.
Wow.
And
that's a long time.
Yeah, it is.
So you've lived here longer than anywhere else, probably, right? Even when you grow up, usually are gone by 17 or 8, right? Then you go to college. Yeah.
I grew up in New Orleans, and then when I was 18, went to college in Arizona.
Yeah.
I like it hot.
At least it's dry there.
Oh, my God. Yeah. This has been crazy. But from probably the first few weeks of moving to Atlanta, I started going to Jalisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And 10 years into living here, I looked at one of the waiters one day. You know, everyone's the same.
Yeah.
You know, and you all do this well, too. It's a family. You take care of them.
Yeah, that's nice.
Take care of you. But I looked at this waiter. I'm like, man, you're getting old. I'm getting old.
I know. I looked at him. So we have had the same, I would have said boy, maybe 2 weeks ago, making pizza at Float Away for 12 years.
Wow.
Same guy, yeah. Oscar. And I looked at him yesterday. And I was like, I didn't say it to him, but I was like, when did he get so old? He's an adult now. He's a man. His wife actually is our baker at for everything. She bakes at Bacchanalia, but for all the restaurants. And I told her today, so I looked at Oscar yesterday. And I was like, oh my God, when did you grow old? And she's like, I know. We all are. But yeah, you know, it's, to have that longevity of staff, there's nothing better than that, really. I mean, you know, they grow up and then they get married and they have kids, and you know, and you knew them when they were 20, so, or sometimes younger. So
it's
that's kind of fun.
I mean, and you know, and being here for as long as I have been, of course, I'm very familiar with you all by restaurant and reputation, and but in reading up on my research for this interview, I'm like, I mean, she is seriously accomplished. Do you feel that way about yourself?
No, not at all. No. I mean, even this, I'm like, barbecue, why me? I mean, I like barbecue, but no, I don't feel that way. I mean, you know, really what we do is we serve people, you know, and I think that lately, maybe the last 10 years, that chefs have become very self-important, you know, in that they're artists. And I do think, you know, that we all are artists, but that doesn't negate the fact that your art is to serve people and make them happy. So I'm always trying to kind of, you know, qualify that with them. It's like, yes, I want you to be creative, and yes, I want you to express yourself, but the bottom line is that it's the experience of the person eating your food, not, you know, how happy you are with the dish. And, you know, that's really hard with the young people now, because they make a dish and they take 15 photos of it, and then it's all over the place. And it's like, somebody's got to eat that. Like, let's get it out of the kitchen, right? But yeah, I think that there's that balance. But no, I think that our business is humbling. You know, it's
your
like
food,
no
food
matter.
Your food is very photogenic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like the food to look good, of course. But I mean, primarily it's just it tastes good, and it should be like kind of hot when it gets to the table, and maybe not too many people have photographed it. But yeah, I think that there's that whole. You know, that sharing thing. I mean, nobody eats food without photographing it now, do they? I mean, everybody, you know, wherever you are, everybody's saying, I mean, myself included. Yeah. I mean, I have a really beautiful dish in a restaurant in New York, and I'm sending it to my staff. I'm like, look at this, you know, we could do this. So, yeah, I think that.
I think it's the access to the story of the chef and the way of sharing that story that's kind of led to this. You called it self-importance, but I'll call it notoriety.
Yeah, self-importance is negative.
Well, you know.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, I think that people want full access. They want everything to be kind of transparent. And, you know, I don't Twitter a lot, but when I tweet, like, and when I do, it's usually, like, something really lovely that I've seen somewhere. But, like, once I just tweeted a picture of my very dear one-eyed dog, and I got the most responses. So I think you're right. Like, people want, like, that personal. But that's kind of always been hard for me. I'm not, like, I'm a bit of an introvert, and I really, like, the whole, like, shaking hands and kissing babies thing has never been me. So I think that's really hard. I just finished writing a book, and when I sold it to the publishers, they were like, you know, you have to include these personal stories about everything, not just like an heading to each chapter, but then, you know, a personal story about each dish. And I was like, what? You know, I mean, that seemed like really. And, you know, I did it, and it wasn't easy. I think it was a little bit hard, but.
What's the book called?
It's called Summerland.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm. And it's really about all the restaurants and everything we do, but they loved the name of our farm. So Summerland is the name of the book.
I like how your family came up with the name. It's where your family vacationed during the summer, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's what, yeah.
Speaking of which, so. I'm going to turn the air down a bit, if
okay.
you don't mind.
No.
But, yeah.
No, yeah, it's where my, so I guess in 1840, my something great, 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 great grandfather bought the property, and yeah, they built a few homes. He did farm it, but that's where the Savannah family would come for the summers because it was cool, a little cooler. I mean, I can't think it was a lot cooler, but, you know, even when we go home some nights, you know, I watch
and
it go. And
this is near Cartersville, Georgia. Right?
Yeah, it's okay. Only about 45 miles, but, you know, it does, the temperature goes down as you get closer, so that's always a little refreshing. But.
Well, you had asked why barbecue, mm-hmm. you know, barbecue is a big topic.
Yeah.
You know, and on Sidewalk Radio, we like to hear about those personal stories that your publisher encouraged you to do in Summerland, the book.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, obviously you're very well respected and established in the restaurant world, and in large part because of the way that you bring food to the table. And we like to, on our episodes, have guests that may not be someone that you necessarily expect, but that you're happy you're here. Mm-hmm. And like, while you might not be like, you know, the backyard barbecue and like, but you definitely know food.
Mm.
And I wanted to talk about some of the elements to barbecue that are not told very often. And it's really, I've found walking a thin line, which is we've grown more accustomed and more interested in where our food comes from, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But like, do you really want to know everything about where it comes from? And a lot of people would say yes. So I wanted to talk about the whole pig.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know the story, and maybe I'm just being a prude and like being a little bit timid of hearing it, but you tell me.
No, I think that that's probably, in essence, what is the most important about all food, yeah. And barbecue, because it is so based on that whole animal that there's a lot of factors that enter into it that make for good or not so good barbecue. And I think it all starts really with how the animals are raised, what they're fed, how they're cared for. I think of, you know, there's reasons that commodity pork and commodity beef have gotten a bad rap. The meat doesn't taste as good. And often it doesn't just not taste as good. Sometimes it doesn't taste at all because the animals have been bred in a way that they grow very, very fast and they have little intramuscular fat. And these are intentional breed outs. They want them to grow fast. They want the pigs to be extra long because extra long means an extra long loin, which is the most valuable part of the pig, as in dollars, gets the most dollars per pound. And people didn't want fat for a long time. And I think fat is now a little bit has gotten a bad rap. I think now it's a little more acceptable because they're finding that maybe animal fat, which our ancestors used for all cooking, is really less harmful to you than some of the modified oils that are used today. But yes, so the breeding is really important. What they're fed and where they live is really important. And it's really important where they're and how they are slaughtered.
Why is that important?
Because there's enzymes in the animal that can react to situations that are stressful prior to the harvest. Let's call it harvest. That's a nice
Thank
word.
You. You're easy.
prior to the harvest. And there's ways that, you know, I mean, certainly this is a big, big topic in the food world is how to most humanely harvest the animals. I mean, there's small producers that we use, and, you know, we're talking small producers that may harvest two or three, maybe four or five animals in a week. So it's not, you know, like the big slaughterhouses that may do 5,000 to 10,000 a day. It's,
I mean, that's somewhat terrifying.
It is terrifying, but it's so mechanized and clean. I mean, I've toured some big slaughterhouses out west in Texas recently, actually. I was even a vegetarian for about a week because I shouldn't say that. But I was like, oh, my God. But, you know, in retrospect,
is there a vegan barbecue movement going on?
After we toured one of them in Texas, they, like, packed us this lunch and it had meat on it. And I'm, like, throwing the meat out the window. I'm like, I'm not eating meat. I think there are many of them that are so clean and sterile and mechanized that, and they're done in such a way that really I think there's very little stress to the animal, which is encouraging for the large plants. But I think that the small producers really like have it done and they understand it. I even know one of our producers where she will take more than one, like it's the buddy system. So when she takes her pigs to slaughter, she takes a couple extras so they get used to the ride. So then they're not as stressed at the ride. So anyhow, what happens is when these adrenaline are released and it can taint the taste of the meat. I've gotten hogs before that have this intermuscular and bleeding that usually means that in some way they were harmed right before their harvest. So, yeah, I think that it's really important to know where your meat comes from. And I think that the quality of the barbecue, it depends on it in a lot of ways. And there's so many of these small barbecue houses here in Atlanta that really do things right. There's even some large ones. I know one large barbecue group, actually, they have stores all over the South, and they're actually producing their own hogs now. I mean, they've gone that far, which, you know, is extremely costly, but it's because they understand that this meat is the most important commodity to them, and they have gone to that extent to make sure that they're fed the right thing before they're harvested. I know we always love our pigs in the fall because they eat apples and acorns, and chestnuts, and they're delicious.
You see, like, Is the patron to the restaurant, do they have to be that sophisticated to taste the difference? Or are you kind of seeing in either reviews or comments with wait staff any type of uptick during that time?
Well, you know, everybody's more informed about everything. And I do think that people really do care about where they're, more and more where their proteins come from. For a long time, it was vegetables, you know. But when you think about it, like eating a protein is, it's probably even more important to know the origin and what that was fed and how it was treated than your carrot, really, when you think about it. I think people are very, do I think that they can all discern a taste? Not necessarily. But I do think sometimes, we especially see it with our cured meats that we do at Star Provisions, you know, the stuff that's aged. And I mean, you can get this like amazing, sweet, nutty flavor from the right pork that you can't get from other. And so in hams and things that are like lightly or seasoned just with salt, you really can tell a difference. And we can tell, I mean, just in the color of the meat, locally raised heritage breed, which is the other part that's important, or a breed that is not a commodity breed, their meat is bright red almost, you know, a dark pink where, you know, sometimes you look at pork, it's almost white, it looks like chicken. Yeah, you can tell that that's probably not a local piece of meat.
Well, you're, you know, both in the decor of your restaurants, which is beautiful, in the preparation, how you procure. You all are very true, and you're purist. You're simple. Do you? What's your feeling about the way that barbecue is going in some of the inventiveness of it? Do you think that that's fun and exciting, or like would you see it better served to be traditional?
I think that I am a purist in a lot, and I think my staff would agree with that I like things like I don't like too many flavors. But I mean, how can you say, I mean, I was just looking at this barbecue, I mean, how can you think that a Korean barbecue sandwich could be bad? What could be bad in that?
Are we talking about heirloom?
Yeah, I mean, it is incredible. So I don't know, that doesn't bother me. I think that everybody should have their own things that are important to them, and and I think they should, I mean, if they can do something really well, they should do it really well. I'm all for it. I think they should express themselves. So, no, I'm not a purist. I would say that there are, you know, there's sometimes I say, well, you know, that would have been better if it was just that, but not often. No.
Let's take this part of the interview to go kind of to the physical development of the city. And we'll talk about the West Side and West Side Provision specifically. Can you give us a little history about that area and why you were attracted to it and what it means for restaurants and food?
Yeah, I was always attracted to, you know, when I moved here, the one thing, and I moved, you know, I've lived around a bit, let's say. You have too, right? Yeah, so I've lived around a bit.
I dropped off my U-Haul at the U-Haul place where Star Provisions is right now.
I know, isn't that crazy? And I think when I moved to Atlanta, the one thing that struck me, and I used to summer here as a kid because we used to come down to my mother's farm and we would come, but I felt like there wasn't much history or tradition or in the buildings, the structures, the town, you know, when you see a beautiful building, I'm always struck by it. Like right behind the Margaret Mitchell House, that row of buildings, I just love those buildings. Right. It's like stunning. And I just wish there was more of that. So then when we got here, and it seemed like, and it still does, that there's this tear down mentality. I mean, how many homes do you see that they tear down, tear down and rebuild this beautiful, huge house where it was? And I don't know, that always disturbed me. So it started when we looked at the Floataway Cafe, and we, you know, they brought me there, the owner of the building, because he saw my home, and I use corrugated aluminum in the home. I mean, how random is that? I use corrugated aluminum that was, you know, on the outside of Floataway, and he's like, I think you'd like this space. Yeah, and it was such a, like, I mean, it was nothing. It was a warehouse. It still had all the stripes painted on the floor where the trucks would back in, and I was just attracted to the fact that they were reworking that building and not tearing it down. So we went in there, and then when they were doing that on the west side, I was like, I can stand behind this. I mean, when you say that you're a purist or that you believe in sustainability, that should go through everything, including your choice of your building materials and your building. You know, to reuse those buildings on the west side, I think, was a really a bold choice and probably an expensive choice. But in the long run, I think it's what has made it such a special corner, especially compared to what it used to be, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Is it an added bonus that the West Side was the meatpacking district of Atlanta?
Yeah, I mean, we have photographs all over the walls. One of the original owners of Star, and it was actually called Star Provisions, that was the pork producer, was where we are. And we have photographs of our dining room when it was their preparation floor where they did all of their meat cutting. And I think it's pretty interesting. I don't know. Sometimes people are like, there's pig goes. I don't think that there's anything in there that's, but it, yeah, I think that it makes perfect sense. People, I mean, it's a nice complete circle. I think it has a nice symmetry. People who grew up here, maybe a little older than me, but not much, they say that that part of town always had like a stench and, you know, you never wanted to go by it. But I kind of think it's endearing that that was where, you know, this, I think, you know, production took place. And now it's kind of a vibrant area of town for good food, which is super.
It's great. I mean, with you all, Miller Union, which,
yeah,
also love. And, I think it's nice that you and they have, in by way of naming, continued a legacy with our cultural heritage. You know, it's like there was the Miller Union Stockyard, mm-hmm. and Abattoir, maybe you can tell the listeners.
Yeah, and Abattoir was actually the name of the slaughterhouse. So on the Star Provision side, it was pork and called Star Provisions. And on the Abattoir, or let's call it the room and board side, because they have the largest amount of property, that side was the cattle. And it was called,
maybe we can call it the beef and board.
The beef and board. And that was actually called, and, you know, that was their name. It was an abattoir. It had a lengthy name, but basically they called it Abattoir, and we took that name. I really think it might have been a mistake in retrospect, because for years everyone was like, I'm a vegetarian. I was like, well, we have a lot of vegetables. But I think that people had that idea that that was where you went for meat and offal. And yeah, so I think that we kind of maybe made a mistake. It was had a connotation. But I don't know. I'm not very inventive with names. I still regret the name Bacchanalia. So I don't know what I was thinking.
Love it.
I know. Like some people do. And certainly there was a time when I did. But it's like long and nobody can say it and nobody can write it. It's I always think that should have been more simple. But
have you been to Bacchanal, by the way, in the back of the quarter in New Orleans?
No, I haven't. I know it's there, but I've never been
Check
there.
It out.
Yeah, I should.
Cool. I mean, it's like it's having a glass of wine in a third world country.
Mm-hmm. I'd like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love New Orleans.
It's cool. So let's you had talked a little bit in the beginning of our chat with when you all bring food home. Interesting, like from the table to the farm.
Yes. Well, because we don't cook at home.
You talked about float away.
Mm-hmm.
But have you ever done any of the backyard barbecue yourself, or do you have any favorites with barbecue?
Well, I mean, I have friends who barbecue. Like, can you say names here?
Sure.
Yeah, I could do whatever. So Dave Roberts is an old friend, so I certainly like Community Q, and I can just call him up, and he'll be like, yeah, come on over. And for a long time before he opened, when he was experimenting, he used to bring big trays of barbecue over to our staff, which, you know, there's nothing that people like more than things that they didn't make that are chefs, right? It's like, yay. So I do like Dave. I mean, we love barbecue, don't get me wrong. We just actually bought two close pits, KLOSE, which are supposed to be very good pits. One for Star Provisions and one for home so that we can smoke. But we build these contraptions and smoke right on our wood burning grills, you know, some series of sheet pans all made into a box, and we slow smoke right now. But we do a lot of smoking with our brisket for our pastrami at Star Provisions. We do probably 10 or 12 briskets a week that I think are just delicious. So we wanted to encourage that. And we just put in another kitchen in the Star Provision space where we're going to be serving meals at night, like up till 8 o'clock at night. Yeah, like kind of family style. And we really want to explore that whole smoke situation for that, because it's attractive, you know. I think there's something very carnal about that, smoking large pieces of meat for a really long time and then getting that reward at the end is, yeah.
Well, it's kind of interesting because, like the word sustainability, which will be defined differently depending on who you ask, mm-hmm. I think it's similar with barbecue. I mean, you're talking about a brisket. Someone might be talking about hamburgers and hot dogs next to the pool.
Yeah. You know? It means something different everywhere, yeah. Or an asado, or, yeah, I mean, there's lots of names for it. So, and I think that it is interpreted in all kinds of ways. Of course, whoever defines the top 10 barbecue places, they all have their differences.
Well, when I first moved to Atlanta, my first job was at Turner, and mm-hmm. I was a content developer. And from there at TNT, and from there I went to Atlanta Magazine, and I'd say it was probably my first week or so on the job, they were judging the best of barbecue, mm-hmm. and like I walked into the room and saw the people judging, I'm like, I don't know what they know that I don't know,
right.
I'm guessing it's something, but you know, sometimes it's just a matter of like taste, preference, right?
Yeah, everybody's a judge. Everybody's a judge. That's the new, right? In our business, all you have to do is write a blog or whatever. Yeah, everybody's
have
a critic.
Little radio show.
But it's true, you know? I mean, everybody has a distinct idea of what they like to eat, and everybody has to eat. You know, it's not like judging, I don't know, skiing. And not everybody skis, but everybody eats, and everybody has an opinion. So, yeah, it's very objective. I think. That's what's kind of cool about barbecue, is that there are so many different kinds. And I mean, Korean barbecue is fantastic. Yeah, I mean, we're always like trying to figure out a way to do that, you know, in our restaurants. Like we'll make beef jerky and wrap it in lettuce leaves with some kimchi at Abattoir because it's so delicious. But yeah, I think that barbecue is really, it's interpreted in many ways. And it's always good.
I know that your time is valuable, and thank you so much for coming
sure.
in. So I'll just have two more questions.
Got it.
One is really more of a shout out, if you will, to the Southern Foodways Alliance. I'd like, if you don't mind, to just tell people what it is and why it's important.
Okay. Well, Southern Foodways Alliance is a brainchild and offshoot of the Southern Foodways Department at the University of Mississippi. And I think that it was their way of branching out into the lay population, should I say, or the non-academics like us. I always find it to be so stimulating because it is all, it's an academic approach to food, which is sometimes unusual, I would say, in our business. You know, we're all about art and all of this, and this is like actually looking back. So John T. Edge and his group of very incredibly smart and interested people are working through oral histories and films. They're working to preserve some of the great stories of food in the South, and it's fascinating. And I can never, like anything I do with them, we always come up with something, you know, that is very old and traditional, but this new take on something to do, some dish, or, and you know, it can be interpreted in any of our restaurants, but it is fascinating to learn the old stories and to talk to the people who have been, you know, making boudin sausage at a gas station in the middle of nowhere, Louisiana.
I believe that I read about that in Gravy. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's It's pretty fascinating. I think, I mean, for us, I think for chefs, we get asked to be involved in a lot of things, and, you know, and support a lot of things. I mean, it's certainly the biggest way to raise funds is to cook for people. But it's like the one place that I think chefs are just like, get the most back from something that they give. You know, I mean, I'm always like, anytime John T wants something, I'm like, absolutely, because I know in the end that I'm only going to be a better chef and a better person and a better Southerner for the time that I've spent involved with them. So it's a great organization.
And is it kind of like when, what's it like when all the chefs get together? Is it like kind of let down your hair, or is it all like, you know, just take a breath, or is it?
It's like eat crappy food and drink bourbon.
Sounds good to me. Yeah. I'll become a chef.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
The next and final question really has very little to do with this, or so I think. But so I just got married last week. And I know that you and your husband have this family business, and you've grown it to, I think, great pride for our city and beyond. Do you have any, this is really all about me now.
Okay.
Give me your advice about marriage and working together.
Well, we worked together long before we were married, but we got married not really for any reason, you know. So we have been working together since 1986. That's a long time, right? What is that? 27 years. It's a long time. And I think that we've both played different roles. Sometimes I was the chef and he worked for me. Sometimes he was the chef and I worked for him. And then this kind of, I think this partnering that we've done. And I don't think it's always easy. Certainly, your business is with you all the time. I think that that's probably the one downside, but it's also the upside because, you know, the day ends and you're still like, there's so much more to do. And sometimes, you know, you just go home and have a drink and talk about things that really needed to be addressed during the day. So it is, it's not easy and it's not hard. I think we've found a way to do it. We did open our second restaurant, Float Away Cafe, because we felt like we needed to be in separate buildings for a little while. So that may happen. And then I don't know, we opened Avatoir. I think, you know, we don't spend a tremendous amount of time together. Usually he's at one place and I'm at another, and we may pass.
So in you have the same career, but in different ways.
Yeah, and he doesn't like he would never sit here and do this. But then he does so much. He does all the farming at home. He does a lot of farming at home. And, you know, I mean, he works an unbelievable amount of hours. You know, I mean, I often, when I'm at home, it's my downtime. He is never down. It's like animal care. And I mean, he just works constantly. But that's kind of how he's wired.
Well, it's something to admire, and I'm so happy that you came in and shared your,
sure,
you know, love of barbecue and just the story with us.
Thanks. Thank it was easy. Thank you. You're welcome. That wasn't as hard as I thought it would be.
Well,